Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, and always respectfully. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby, and one of our principles is nonpartisanship. Today we're going to be talking to Aaron Lieberman. He's the executive director of the Idaho Outfitters and Guides Association. Aaron lives and works every day in that nonpartisan world, the intersection of various interests in a clean and pristine environment, sometimes from a perspective of a river rafter, sometimes from the perspective of someone who works in an office. It's a small world that we live in, and we all share this environment regardless of our perspectives. And so taking care of the environment, and in particular climate change, is a nonpartisan challenge. So let's pick up the conversation with Aaron, and I'll talk to you on the other end. So we're really fortunate to have Aaron Lieberman with us today. He's the executive director of the Idaho Outfitters and Guides Association. We're going to be learning something about him and his organization. And so I'm looking forward to the conversation, and appreciate you being with us today, Aaron.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John.
So, just out of curiosity, where are you in Idaho today? I guess you're in Idaho.
I am in Idaho, and I am I'm talking to you and you all from the Sawtooth Valley in view of the Sawtooth Mountains here near the headwaters of the Middle Fork of the Salmon River, which might play into some of the conversation today surrounding fish.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what kind of a day do you have out there today?
Oh, it's beautiful. Just, I continue, though I live here for portions of the year, I continue to be awed every time I look out over the mountains. And today is one of those beautiful days in the valley, blue skies, sun dappling this this side of the ridge. Can't complain.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it seems like you probably have a blessed life with the ability to enjoy nature. And of course, Idaho is a whole bunch of wilderness, so you got lots of it there. And I certainly get the mountains thing here in Tacoma on the Puget Sound. I have a view of the Olympic Mountains, and it's a little bit the same thing. I've been looking at those mountains for 40 years and love looking at them every time I see them. So, okay, so Aaron, why don't you tell us a little bit about Idaho Outfitters and Guides Association, what the purpose of your organization is.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Idaho Outfitters and Guides Association is a nonprofit 501c6 business trade association representing and advocating for outfitters and guides, as the name would suggest, from all sectors of the industry. So from hunting, fishing, rafting, kayaking, mountaineering, zip lining, ATV tours, backcountry skiing, you name it. And it was established in 1954, not too far away from where I am now in Salmon, Idaho, just there on the other side of the Idaho side of the Continental Divide. The original mission statement, which hasn't really changed much of the organization, expresses a commitment to conservation and enhancement of quality outdoor experiences on Idaho's lands and waters. It's an interesting type of organization in a lot of ways. You know, we are fundamentally a business trade association, so representing the industry needs. But where it's, I think, unique in some ways is that ours is an industry where there's not really a separation between the needs of the industry and some other, I guess, higher or more in some ways more abstract and concrete values. So preservation and conservation of both, you know, the quality recreational and natural resources, as well as flora fauna that we rely on and value in the industry. So it's an interesting overlap between business trade and advocacy as associations go.
Just as a layperson, it seems pretty clear to me that your advocacy and your trade or your industry concerns are very tightly connected. I mean, what does your industry do if you lose the beauty of the Idaho wilderness?
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, and, you know, we were, as an organization, we've been involved in going back, you know, from working with Frank Church, you know, who's a historic advocate for wilderness, not least in Idaho, as well as in the establishment of Boulder White Clouds, in support of Representative Simpson here from Idaho. So there's a, I mean, whether in terms of actual designations, land and protection that way, you know, if I could guess another great example is the Owyhee Initiative, which IOGA was and actually is still a part of, which is tries to maintain sort of balance between multiple uses, but also protection and access in the Owyhee Jar Bridge area. So it's a, yeah, we are, there's no separation for our industry or really our people between, you know, what they do for work and the inherent value and protection of the things that allow them to do that work, which is those natural areas, preservation of their quality and of the, you know, fish and wildlife that if they're in that sector that they rely on.
Yeah, I get that for sure. And I'd like to, we're going to dig into that maybe a little bit more here in a second, but why don't you tell us a little bit about who Aaron Lieberman is? How the heck did he end up to be the executive director of the IOGA?
Who knows? Yeah. Who am I? What a existential questions. Well, I guess in basic terms, I'm a native of Southwest Oregon, far Southwest Oregon, just right near where the Rogue and Applegate Valley meet. So from outside of this place, a small little town, but grew up there and started guiding when I was actually 17, which I could at the time in Oregon, with a rafting outfitter based out of Merlin, Oregon, who also operates in Idaho. So I started guiding, you know, shoulder seasons in the Rogue, Klamath North Umpqua, Owyhee, John Day, all those, Cal Salmon a bit. And then for the primary season for the last however many years that is, started guiding in Idaho on the main, lower and middle fork of the Salmon, Payette, some of those rivers. So, you know, it was always supposed to be a summer gig. And then the plan was either to be president or an ambassador. And so I majored in German and international relations with a minor in Arabic in college, and then ended up not being able to get away from guiding. And so I found off-season gigs, telling myself I'd go to grad school at some point, but just still couldn't get away from the river or these places. And then ultimately started running operations year-round and then still guiding for a rafting outfitter. And almost 2 years ago now, took on the position with IOGA. That's the summary overview of Aaron.
Yeah. So we've talked about this a little bit offline, that I grew up just really a few miles from where you grew up. I grew up right on the Rogue River, and there was a 10-mile stretch of that river that I knew every rock on. And I also caught my first fish on the Rogue there just up above the Gold Hill Bridge. So pretty special place in my memory. So do you think that your childhood experience growing up there in that beautiful part of Oregon has influenced the direction of your life in general?
And yes, and probably and almost certainly more than I know. And but to the degree that I do know, I think pretty fundamentally, you know, I think a big part of, well, you know, you grew up in that place as well, and there, you really don't have many options. It's either you go outside and you enjoy those, what you do have there, that natural bounty, or else you play, well, I guess in my generation, I didn't have a TV, but other kids may have had the option of playing video games, or unfortunately, in more recent decades, you get into meth. So between those three options, I chose the outdoors, which, you know, pretty okay with that decision. And I think it has fundamentally influenced who I am and why I am where I am and why I made the decisions that I did make, which is to be in beautiful places and wild places, you know, the important places and experiences that matter.
Yep, for sure. I get you 100%. Of course, when I was a kid, we barely had TV. In fact, I can still remember when we got our first TV set, but life on the river was fantastic, and it was always interesting, always changing, always challenging. And I look back on those days with a lot of nostalgia, including the fact that our parents were just sort of like, yeah, why don't you guys go down and play by the river?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can certainly relate to that part. My, my mom's go-to, alternative to daycare or babysitters was she would go up the Applegate a ways and drop my sister and I off without life jackets and say, just swim down, swim down to Turtle Lane. So it'd be a full day, just swim. You know, and there's nothing too big there. It's class two, class three. And I look back in hindsight thinking, man, that is a bold parenting decision.
Yep. Worked. Absolutely. Yeah. You'd be getting a visit from some governmental authority these days.
Yeah.
So I want to get back to something that you touched on back there a little bit, and that is this fact that your organization, while it is an industry, is also very closely tied to the pristine or pristine as possible, natural as possible environment. So I guess I would call myself, just loosely speaking, an environmentalist. I mean, I care a lot about every aspect of the environment, most particularly right now, of course, climate change. But I'm just wondering, the folks in your organization, how do they feel about somebody that would be called an environmentalist? Do they feel like they're on the same side, or there's some potential conflict there, or what do you think?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting question. And in some ways, kind of a complex one. You know, I guess I would say first it's a mix, right? So our industry is really diverse. Not just in terms of activities, but in terms of politics, culture, just even within, in individual terms within the industry. And so, you know, I think for probably half of our folks, the term or the notion or the concept of environmentalists would be a familiar or, you know, familiar one that they probably would ascribe to themselves, a label they describe to themselves. And for half of them, unfortunately, I think they would say, like, oh, those environmentalists, they're the problem. The irony in terms of the latter is that all of our members, which is, you know, Outfitters and Guides Across Idaho, are in practical terms environmentalists and conservationists. I think those terms have become really, you know, they're value words, and they've become really politically laden in a way that has obfuscated what they actually mean fundamentally. And so I think altogether, beyond self-concept or self-identification, that our members are, as a rule, environmentalists and conservationists in their day-to-day values and practices, in many ways more than most who would tout the term. So it's, you know, I guess that gets, it's at a certain level, it gets into the metaphysical realm of, you know, how we see ourselves versus what we do and how we might be described from the outside in. But there is certainly a deep and very practical practice of environmental protection and conservation within the industry.
Yeah. So I think that this is bringing up what I think is a really important point, and that is, for whatever reason, these days in particular in our culture, it seems like we want to jump to the places that we are in disagreement, and we've set aside all of the places that we are in agreement, the values that we hold in common, and everybody kind of squabbling for their own little chunk of attention. I, as a climate activist, I actually experience this a lot right within the climate movement, that folks are concerned about climate, that everybody's got their own answer to what the problem is, and it seems like there's as much squabbling internally as there is productive effort in addressing the problem. So I'm really hopeful that as time passes, we'll get past this kind of confrontational, conflictual situation that we've got right now. And I, just in listening to you, it's just real clear. In fact, you make the point that in a lot of ways, the folks that are out there working in the wilderness really are more connected to the environment, maybe more concerned about the environment than somebody who's sitting in an office in Olympia or Seattle or Boise, well, as far as that goes.
They're more direct. They're practitioners of the principle, whether or not they, and some do and some don't, but whether or not they would define themselves in within that, you know, within that typology. And I think, you know, I guess I couldn't, so I really agree with you in terms of the contentiousness and the divisiveness of these terms and those conversations that fall out of them. But I think really the we won't get by the disagreements, and we shouldn't aim for that, right? Because the point of dialogue is dialogue. But to see each other more clearly, to arrive at some sort of synthesis, like that dialectic, right? So I think what I think you do the show and, you know, in your life is how we productively get there. It's just having the conversations in the first place and breaking them down into component parts versus these top level or labels of, you know, Democrat, Republican, environmentalist or not. Like, if we look at them that way, we misunderstand what we're even talking about. So these are the way, this is the way that we do those things.
Yep. Every show, when I'm introducing the program at first, I make the comment that we're talking about everything climate, and we always do that respectfully. And the reason I say that is because if we can't learn to listen to each other carefully and at the very least understand the perspective of the other person, then we're never going to get to where we want to be with the environment or anything else. One of the things I believe I heard you say is that rafting is a part of your organization's interest.
Yeah. Yep. Rafting, fishing, kayaking, jet boating, all those things. Yeah.
So, I mean, I've done a little rafting on the Rogue River and a couple other places, and I'm pretty sure the folks that do that rafting, the reason they're doing it in big part is because they want to see that wilderness that nobody else can see driving their car down the highway, be up close to it. Of course, there's the thrill of crashing through the rapids and pretending like you might drown or something.
Yeah.
It does seem in particular that there are so many of the activities that your folks do that are so related to an appreciation of the environment. So I want to ask you, are you seeing any impacts of climate change in the environment as you watch it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you know, and I imagine you mean more specifically to the industry or people in the industry here in Idaho, or, you know, I guess in Idaho. And yes, certainly. So I'll start with a segue off of river people, rafters, kayakers, fishermen and such. Even just to start with, you know, the impacts of climate change on temperatures, and that in turn snowpack and how that affects seasons. So, for example, you know, historically, we look at a year like this year, and just isolated maybe to where I'm near here. So here, the headwaters of the Middle Fork of the Salmon, one trend in Idaho that has become increasingly clear over the past 10 years or so is warming temperatures in general. And with several exceptions, fairly significantly reduced snowpack, and not least reduced snowpack, but retention. So how quickly or when that starts melting off. So getting warmer earlier in the spring and causing these sort of more variable and stunted freshets. So when you have that peak runoff. So where historically we might see, you know, into mid to late June runoff, more of that big freshet where you just have a big burst of high water coming down and then sort of retentive levels carrying through mid to late July. More often than not, over the last 10 years, we're seeing that runoff happen, that attenuated runoff starting maybe a month earlier than that, and then another sort of mid peak around the time we'd expect the major peak historically, and then levels dropping down by mid to late July to where they would historically have been in late August, early September. And that affects everything in a rafting operation. And that's just one place that's just one starting point on those impacts. I mean, the others, those water levels or climate change writ large, also affects outfitters here in Idaho. I mean, on down the line, and that complicated web of how things impact each other. So, you know, warming temperatures and warming oceans leading to things like extended or an extension of or augmentation of an extended duration of Pacific decadal oscillations, like the blob, and that impacting in turn anadromous fish populations, their health, or their health and survivability in the ocean, that in turn affecting the returns of those anadromous stocks to Idaho to spawn, that in turn affecting fishing outfitters. Differing winter conditions, changing overwintering survival in elk and deer populations, and changing where they spend their time and how they start interacting with. I mean, they end up getting pushed down in recent years, and elk, for example, are getting pushed down into lower elevations earlier than they might otherwise, which is putting them in conflict with, you know, ranchers and landowners. Which then you have culling of certain populations, because I don't know if you've ever tried to get an elk out of a cornfield, but it's like getting a dog, getting a bone away from a dog. They're pretty reluctant. So, you know, in all the multifarious ways, yes, that climate change certainly is impacting or has impacts and very direct impacts on these resources and in turn on outfitters and guides.
Yeah, this is really interesting to hear you say, because just for instance, you made reference to the blob, which people who are concerned about climate change will be familiar with. But there's also this tendency to think of things that are far away as not affecting me as an individual. That here we are talking about a blob, you know, basically warm water in the Pacific Ocean, and folks' lifestyles and incomes are affected by it up in the mountains in Idaho. So even though stuff is seeming far away sometimes, we're all affected one way or the other. So you mentioned snowpack, which is certainly an interesting thing too, as a state of Washington, as you'd be well aware. I'm wondering, have you seen any impacts from the mountain pine beetle?
Yeah, there are. So with any number, I mean, Idaho is actually a bit better off in terms of invasive, and in particular invasive pests, than, you know, places like where we come from in Oregon. But yeah, there are impacts there. You know, another, and this is kind of a segue, but it's actually a pretty relevant one that I forgot to mention. Another impact, I think, that climate change and what changing atmospheric patterns is having in Idaho that is really wreaking havoc in a lot of ways is with less snowpack and with less just overall precipitation or, you know, periods of precipitation. We have much less moisture density in our forest lands, and that, you know, leading to these catastrophically large fires that just are roaring through the landscape almost every year. But yeah, they're, you know, the impacts from pine beetles, not as much here. Yeah, not as much here. We have some other invasives that I'm not too excited about, but they're mostly aquatic invasives.
Yeah, understood. So what about fires? I mean, I did a little scanning, and there are some fires going in Idaho right now. What's the experience been in the last few years with wildfires?
You know, last year was, we had a reprieve last year, but the 2000 was a really bad, well, just enormously bad fire season in almost every single year. And in particular with increasing sort of consistency over the past 15, 20, just Idaho's had, much like Oregon and California and Washington, had just consistent, large, and devastating fires. Just, you know, tinder dry forest land going up in flames. Man, that's the summary version. I guess the summary statement on fires in Idaho, it's not great. It's not great. Yep. There's a, yeah. And those, and they have their own impacts on, you know, in other areas. So you have this sort of loose soil with all the roots burned out, or, you know, without the support of the actual trees, vegetation, supporting those riparian areas that end up tumbling down and creating more landslides and log jams, things like that in the rivers. So the impacts, as they always do, trickle down, except in Reaganomics, it didn't work that way there.
Yeah. So gotcha. And the, I just want to underscore the point that I believe I'm hearing you make, and that is, okay, a fire goes through and we tend to think, okay, well, there go the trees, but the ramifications go on far beyond, okay, you lost trees. As you referred to it, the trickle down impacts lots of other things, and we see that everywhere, of course. One of the things I wanted to ask you, I like to get what I call canary in the coal mine statistics or data, stuff that lay people can understand, because if you start digging too deep into ecology, it can get pretty wonky. So run us through what you've seen in terms of salmon runs over the last, however many years you want to pick, 10 or 15, something like that. What's going on with the salmon runs?
Oh, well, I mean, I can go 10 to 15 and I can go back further. I'll go from global to local, that there is a clear downward arc, statistically speaking, of wild salmon and steelhead returns to Idaho, starting in particular with the installment of the Lower Four Snake River dams. And so to put it, I guess I'll try to keep it top level. If you look to tribal sources in the entire Columbia watershed, they speak to catch numbers. So that's not return, but catch numbers between 5 and 9 million. Just on salmon, not including steelhead. And then if you go to more, less oral tradition and tribal numbers, so more recently, I guess I'll ground it also in Idaho. So the snake and its tributaries have a disproportionate importance in the Columbia Basin in terms of salmon and steelhead and those stocks and spawning habitat. Historically, the Snake River produced about 55% of the total Columbia summer steelhead, 45% of total Columbia Basin summer Chinook, 39% of the total Columbia Basin spring Chinook. In the 1880s, Idaho was producing 1.5 million wild Chinook, and Snake River stocks over in that period since, so we're talking about a big period now, have shown declines by as much as 99%. Numbers have had, in 95, the run of wild Chinook was around 1167, I think. And more recently, what we're looking at in 2017, we had 4,000, somewhere in there. This year is one of the worst years on record, and I'm speaking of wild at this point. This year has been one of the worst years. I think it actually is the worst year on record, where we had, I think, a total, actually have the number here, but a total of 800 harvest share of spring Chinook. It's not expected that the Clearwater River, which is a pretty key spawning area, will even reach broodstock. They had about they're going to be about 1,300 fish short of just broodstock. So those are the wild fish they take just to be able to maintain a hatchery supplementation program. So the summary statement is, it is a downward spiral of salmon and steelhead populations. With Idaho being the most productive spawning ground for all anadromous fish populations in the Columbia Basin.
Well, it's just as really, I guess I got to say, it's painful just to hear what's been going on with the fish. And having grown up on a salmon river, I mean, I got to say, I believe we had a relationship with those fish. I mean, we admired them, we ate them, we understood their patterns or habits. Our dog used to, a salmon after it had died, after it had spawned, our dog used to love to go and rub himself in it for some reason.
Yeah.
So they were a part of our life. And I also, I think a lot of, let's call them city folks for lack of a better term, don't understand the difference between hatchery fish and wild fish. When I was fishing the Rogue River, I was just a kid, so I was fishing for trout, and I can still remember, we called them planted trout, the ones that were from the hatcheries, and I can still remember the first one I caught, and I thought there was something wrong with it. I thought it was sick, as compared to the wild fish that I was used to catching. So for a canary in the coal mine, the salmon are telling us in 1,000 ways, we need to change our practices, or we're going to lose them altogether.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I would. I think it also it's important on this issue to qualify what can explain that decline. So in part, actually, you know what, I'll start actually with your point about our connection to these fish, and then I'll go there, because I think that's also really important. For me, it's a really important part of the conversation, and I think for the folks I represent. You know, I think there's a tendency for this conversation, as with the climate, you know, climate change and environmental conversations, to create binaries so we can understand things, or so it seems simpler to us. And to say, you know, we just care about wild fish because we care about wild fish, or we don't care about wild fish because we don't value those things. And, you know, those sorts of blacks and whites. And there is a connection both individually, culturally, spiritually. You know, folks in the communities, not least the one I'm in right now, and, you know, fishing outfitters, river outfitters and guides to these fish and to the landscape itself. I mean, you can find salmon DNA in trees half a mile up the mountain from the river. There is an inherent connection there. There's also an aspect of sort of cultural heritage and generational continuity that these fish provide. So, I mean, you talk about catching a salmon on the Rogue, and I can't tell you how many conversations you have with outfitters, guides, or the people they take down, where that tradition going out with your mom or your dad and catching your first salmon and passing that along to other people, in no small part informs like a sense of family, community, tradition, transition, like the sense of a place. I mean, think of the number of places in Idaho named after salmon and steelhead. I mean, I'm 2 hours away from the town of Salmon, and as a guide recently, or outfitter recently, wrote in a letter to me, you know, it's like, I live along the banks of the Salmon River, and I can't tell you the last time that I saw a salmon in the Salmon River. So there is a very deep connection between all of us in these areas and these resources, not least these fish, to their decline, and understanding those sources, which I do think is important. Let's say one thing there are many things that play a part in the decline of salmon and steelhead populations in Idaho. So we talk about the 4-H's: hydro, hatchery, harvest, and habitat, and then ocean and predation are added on there, and all of those play a role. In terms of habitat, which ties into questions of ecology and environment and climate change, we could point to things like lacking functional riparian areas, disconnected tributary habitats, excessive sedimentation, structural barriers, so some of those being natural and most of those being man-made or imposed, as limiting factors in terms of habitat. So we talk about reconnecting streams and making them more complicated to create that spawning rearing habitat in terms of fixes to that. And, you know, I could run through the others, but the long and short is that many people want to point to, and relevant to this conversation, many people do want to point to climate change and ocean conditions as the reason why, in particular, in the last 20 years, we have such precipitous declines of salmon and steelhead. And it is true that certainly plays a role. But the longitudinal factor that we can point to is the hydro system, which increases water temperatures in reservoirs, increases drastically the water transit time, which is how long it takes that little smolt to get down from where it was spawned down to the ocean, and powerhouse encounters, which is, you know, the man-made thing, including man-made sort of predatory traps that these reservoirs represent. Those things do tie into environment. And I think the canary part is, or maybe I guess it, segueing off the canary part, one way I think of our opportunity in Idaho is, for these fish in particular, is to be like an arc. So as we go forward and the impacts of climate change, well, unfortunately, but seemingly continue to increase, Idaho has the most high elevation cold water refugia habitat of anywhere in the country, maybe even the world. It's the highest spawning right here, not just 20 minutes from where I am. Salmon spawn at 7,000 feet, you know, so it's when I think about Idaho and climate change and these fish, I think that we have an opportunity, if we can get them past these man-made obstacles and the impacts of those man-made obstacles, even beyond the obstacles themselves, then we can potentially forestall the extinction of these fish because we have that cold water refugia that is going to become more and more limited across the West Coast and broadly as climate change continues.
Yeah, I love the way you sketch that whole thing out, and I absolutely get your point. While I'm focused in to a large extent on climate change, there are so many factors in what's going on with our environment, and we ignore the significant ones at our own peril. And so that's part of my dream is that a larger part of our population will become more and more concerned, and we will take the political challenges up and make the changes that we need to make to address all of these kinds of things. So we're getting close to out of time here, Aaron. By the way, I've been loving this conversation. It's a little bit of nostalgia for me, too, talking about the days down there in southwestern Oregon. So what would you like to add before we finish up here, if anything?
Well, John, I've really enjoyed the conversation, too. I maybe a couple of things. I'll start with just saying, you know, one of the points I would like to make just on in terms of where you come from on these things and where I added the additional context is really to underscore the importance of what you're driving at, what you're focused in on, because we can point to all the things that we can control, but if we don't acknowledge the overriding impacts of climate change on these populations, then we will diminish the importance of the things we can control. And so I think the conversation around this, like, you know, climate change is real, which is sad that we still have to have that conversation at some level, but that climate change is real. Here are its impacts, and here are its impacts directly on your lives, on the places where you live, on your livelihoods. Then it gives more, I think it opens more space to have the conversations around what areas we can control more directly than reversing the impact or than reversing or, you know, attenuating climate change. So I guess one thing would just be thank you for having these conversations. You know, and I could, the only other thing I could add is just a shameless plug for folks to reconsider, and it require maybe more conversation, but reconsider the way that we think about power and fish and environment, and really to be more bold and more creative in thinking about what future, both structurally and environmentally, we want to create for ourselves with each other, you know, working together, rather than sort of staying in our own camps and entrenching behind our own banners. Because on so many fronts, not least fish, we will need to be fundamentally different ways than we have historically, and we haven't quite gotten there. So I guess that's a very broad summary outro.
Yeah, well, so very well put, and I'm gonna remember the way that you've put that here for a while. I also just want to throw out for our listeners, I saw a webinar that Aaron was on. I'm a little vague on exactly what it was, but him talking about the situation for the outfitters and guides in Idaho, and I picked up his passion for that. And I did not ask Aaron anything about climate change prior to going in here. So everything that Aaron has said is regarding climate change is his perspective, and not something that we had particularly planned on focusing on in this conversation. So that was particularly valuable and enlightening to me. So I guess we'll finish up here, Aaron. I'm making a little note to myself to make it over there to Idaho sometime and do something with you where we forget about all of this politics, et cetera, and just go out and have some fun. And once again, I really appreciate you taking the time with us, and wish you and your organization all the best.
Hey, thanks so much, John. I appreciate it.
Well, there you have it. And I got to say that Aaron is a pretty amazing guy, and it's clear how much he has invested both mind and heart in the wilderness and keeping it clean and pristine for future generations. I'll add a link to his organization, the Idaho Outfitters and Guides Association, in the program notes for today. You can find those program notes at ccltacoma.org. Just look for the icon for Climate Talk. And I'd also love to hear from you if you have some response to today's show or any other show. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org. So that's it for now. Once again, I'm reminding you, as always, live like the mountain is out. Take care.